Chapter 15. Out of Touch. The conference call began around 5 a.m. on Tuesday, August 30th, 2005. I'd been up a while, unable to sleep. We'd arrived in California the day before from Texas, where the president, as usual, was spending much of August working out of his home in Crawford. Along with many others on the staff, he was still operating on Central Standard Time. The president had come to San Diego to make some remarks commemorating the 60th anniversary of VJ Day in a speech to veterans, Marines, Special Operations Forces, Navy officers, sailors, and aviators at Naval Air Station North Island. Secretary Rumsfeld, traveling separately, was there as well. After that, Bush was scheduled to visit some wounded Navy SEALs and Marines at the nearby medical facility before returning to Crawford for the last few days of the summer. One of the fringe benefits of being on the president's traveling staff, or road crew, as we often referred to ourselves, was staying with him in luxury hotels. On this trip, my room in the historic Hotel del Coronado, a five-star resort on San Diego's Coronado Island, locally known as the Del, was just a few rooms down the hall from the president's. The trip west had been planned long in advance. No one could have anticipated that this would be the weekend when a catastrophic hurricane would hit the United States. The sheer size of Hurricane Katrina's reach and destructive power, covering more than 90,000 square miles, was difficult to imagine. The purpose of this morning's conference call was to update some of the president's key team members on the current situation in the aftermath of the storm and, most important, make a determination about Bush's immediate plans. We'd known for a while that the hurricane would be a bad one. President Bush had taken the unusual step of declaring both Louisiana and Mississippi disaster areas on the previous Saturday and Sunday, respectively, before the hurricane hit. He'd made these declarations at the request of Governors Kathleen Blanco and Haley Barbour, with whom the administration had been in contact, in part so that the cost of the emergency preparations being made by the states could be reimbursed after the fact by the federal government. A series of increasingly drastic preparatory steps had been taken, including, on Sunday morning, the first mandatory evacuation order in the history of New Orleans, issued by Mayor Ray Nagin. The president had urged him to do so in a call. Yet as the hours ticked by, the news kept getting worse, hence the need for the morning's conference call. Back in Washington, Dan Bartlett had initiated the call through the White House Signal, a military-run operator service for national security matters and senior staff that's part of the White House Communications Agency, WACA. WACA provides full communication support to the president, the vice president, the National Security Council, the Secret Service, and the White House senior staff, including secure and non-secure communications. Among those on the call were Chief of Staff Andy Card, who was vacationing in Maine, Deputy Chief of Staff for Policy and Senior Advisor Carl Rove, Bartlett, Deputy Chief of Staff for Operations Joe Hagan, and myself. Hagan and I were traveling with President Bush. Among his other White House duties, he served as the internal point person for coordinating with administration officials in charge of natural disaster response. In retrospect, I wasn't at my best during that time period. Just a few weeks earlier, I'd been exposed as having passed along the false assertion that Carl Rove had not been involved in leaking the identity of Valerie Plame. As a result, my credibility as presidential spokesperson had suffered quite a blow. Something I was reminded about frequently during my increasingly stressful hours at the podium in the White House press room in the immediate aftermath of the revelation. Those events had taken an enormous psychic toll on me, and I needed a break from Washington, away from colleagues, away from the spotlight, a time to clear my head and recover. So my wife Jill and I had taken a few days off and traveled to a remote hideaway in North Carolina with our two dogs. Nonetheless, I was still feeling sapped and a little depressed as that fateful week began. Unshowered and unshaven, clad only in a t-shirt and shorts, I had just started to scan some of the morning news programs. The newspapers delivered to my door said that New Orleans had apparently been spared a catastrophic hit, but the morning programs with journalists on the spot were showing just the opposite. I had yet to receive my daily morning summary, which would include an internal Katrina situation report from the White House Situation Room. The phone rang. Dan Bartlett and I were the first connected to the call. In the moments before the others logged on, Dan gave me a brief update on what he knew about the situation. "It's bad," Dan said. "A worst-case scenario in New Orleans. A lot of the Gulf Coast along southeast Louisiana and Mississippi was wiped out, too." But the most shocking news concerned the devastation of New Orleans. Much of the city rests below sea level in a bowl-shaped depression encircled by levees and flood walls. Katrina was a massive Category 3 hurricane with storm surges of up to 25 feet as its eye passed some 40 miles to the city's southeast. Its width had expanded as it reached shore, and hurricane-force winds extended 103 miles from its center. The levees were now definitively confirmed to have been breached, which meant that the floodwaters would not be going away anytime soon. One by one, the president's team members were connected to the call. We did not share a detailed situation report. We'd all heard how bad the situation had become, either through the pictures and words on our TV screens or through internal White House reports. We understood that Katrina had wreaked enormous havoc and came to quick agreement that the president needed to return to Washington sooner rather than later. The plan we formulated was to have the president return home to Crawford immediately following his morning visit to the naval base and the hospital. That would give everyone in the president's entourage the evening to pack their belongings in Texas and return to Washington the following morning. In retrospect, we should have gone straight back to D.C., but no one seemed to feel that the circuitous route back would hurt as long as the president was staying on top of things, and the public knew he was cutting short his Texas stay. "Yeah, and can we have the president do a flyover in Air Force One?" Karl Rove suggested. "We should have him looking out and surveying the damage in New Orleans and along the coast of Mississippi and Alabama as he returns to D.C. As usual, Rove was thinking about the political perceptions. That was Rove's job, and no one did it better. His thinking in this case was obvious. A flyover would at least reflect the president's concern. Rove's political instincts in such situations were usually on target, but this suggestion made me uneasy. I didn't like the idea, and I spoke up quickly. "I think that's a bad idea," I asserted. "He'll be 10,000 feet up in the air, looking down at people being rescued off rooftops. He'll look out of touch and detached. If he goes, he needs to be on the ground visiting with those affected and seeing the damage up close." I added, "Or at least an aerial tour in a helicopter if he can't go on the ground. If he can't do that, then he should just go straight back to D.C. without a flyover." "I agree," Bartlett added instantly, and no one else objected. I felt the matter had been put to rest. There would be no Katrina flyover. I was pretty confident my instincts and judgment on this issue were sound. I remembered as a kid tagging along with my mother when she was mayor of Austin as she personally visited a neighborhood ravaged by a killer flood. And I remembered how, only a year before, Joe Hagan and I had accompanied the president as he visited Florida four times in a few weeks, each after a major hurricane damaged homes and neighborhoods. The president understood his role as comforter-in-chief in such situations, and he performed it remarkably well, showing genuine care and concern for victims. He would take walking tours of damaged neighborhoods, observing the wreckage to homes and offering comfort and support to devastated families. His Florida trips had included helicopter tours with the governor, his brother Jeb, and other officials, so he could see the scope of the damage firsthand. Hagan understood this dynamic well and always worked to make sure events were planned accordingly. By contrast, a Katrina flyover in the luxury of the world's most recognizable 747 would create in the minds of the press and the people an image of a callous, unconcerned president. If we weren't going to hit the ground immediately, I felt it was better to get back to D.C. and assume greater control over the emergency response. So I was glad to get that sense of reassurance from the conference call that there would be no flyover in Air Force One. Unfortunately, I'd accepted that reassurance a little too quickly. The conversation wrapped up a short time later, as final plans were discussed. "At the first event this morning," I said, "I will tell the press pool about the change in plans. I'll let them know a trip to the Gulf Coast region is expected by the end of the week. I'll also let reporters know about the updates the president is receiving and that he'll likely participate in a video conference tomorrow morning from his ranch." Everybody was good with the game plan. But President Bush was one step ahead of us. When the call ended and Hagan went to tell him what we thought, Bush spoke first. He told Hagan he had already decided he needed to return to Washington. The entire team swung into action, beginning a new improvised scene in the elaborately choreographed dance that is a presidential trip.